Health and Fitness with David Hollywood, with the all-new Midlands Park Health and Fitness Club, midlandsparkhotel.com.
Midlands 103.
Hello and welcome to Health and Fitness on Midlands 103. I'm Cameron Clark, filling in for your usual host David Hollywood, who's no doubt off enjoying a well-deserved break. We've got a packed show tonight. We'll hear about the challenges faced by people living with a neuromuscular condition, accessing third level education, and the launch of a new report which is calling on the government and policymakers to address these accessibility challenges. We'll also hear from Blizzard's frontman and mental health advocate Brezzy on the live show he's bringing to Athlone next week, and a man who eats sugar in a weight loss campaign. But first, the National Camogie Association has launched its new strategy for the next 3 years, which aims to increase attendance at games, grow membership and build capacity for referees and coaches. It comes on the back of a large-scale research project put together by the association, which surveyed existing members and players on the positive experiences they've had, as well as some of the challenges they face. Uachtaráin of the National Camogie Association, Hilda Breslin, joins me on the line this evening, and maybe we'll start by running through the key targets of this strategy.
Certainly, and we launched this during the week, and it's from 2024 up to bring us right up to the end of 2026. In many ways, we went with a strategy because we're recognising that integration is also on the horizon. So this is to enable us to complete the strategy within the period before we would envisage that integration has happened. So some of the very, I suppose, the key ones and the headline ones are that our intention by 2026 to increase our attendance at the All-Ireland Final up to 50,000. So we're currently, this year, we broke 30,000 for the first time, and we envisage by 2026 that we will reach 50,000. We currently have 720 clubs, and we are looking at aiming having 750 clubs, so 30 more clubs, and a 10% increase in membership. So we currently sit at 120,000 members, a 10% increase in players. And then some of, I suppose, the other stuff that we're looking at is we're looking at increasing our coach developers, our match officials, and our broadcast and our overall attendance figures. So they're probably the high level targets as such. And I think what we wanted to do was we wanted to be very clear. We wanted to pick out targets that were achievable, but also that were ambitious.
So let's maybe delve into that first target, the reaching an attendance for the All-Ireland Final of 50,000 by 2026. Not overly far away. And the most recent attendance, like you said, is 30,000. Do you feel it's realistic that you can add another 20,000 to that attendance? It is a massive target. It's a massive goal.
Yes, look, it's a significant goal, but I think on the back of it is an increase in what we would say is an increase in our marketing and our strategy. And that's what's going to be the key behind it. We've seen over the last 3 years, we've increased our sponsorships significantly. We've increased our media presence, and we've increased our partnership with RTE. And now what we're saying is we've put the building blocks in many ways. And now what we're going to seek to do is we're going to seek to return on all of that investment. But it is going to be challenging, I suppose. But I think it is very achievable. And, you know, we've 120,000 members alone. We can fill Crow Park. So, I mean, I think sometimes we forget this, that even if we just brought half of our membership, we would be filling and making these targets. So I think in those ways, it's about activating our attendances, activating them at all of the round games, and then culminating in an All-Ireland attendance.
Jumping off your mentioning of the Camogie's membership there, we'll maybe move on to the second point, which is growing membership and club numbers by 10% as part of this strategy. What will be the keys to achieving that goal, and what will be the barriers in preventing it?
Look, one of the key to achieving it is that we have to ensure that everybody, when they participate, are enjoying it and that they want to participate in Camogie at whatever level that is. And even if, you know, is that social Camogie, is that competitive inter-county Camogie, is that in administration roles? And one of the, I suppose, the issues that we would see is post-COVID, and COVID definitely has seen a decrease, and we are trying to play a catch-up in membership, which we've been very fortunate in the Camogie Association to achieve that. But participation in sport fell during COVID, and participation for females in sport fell further during COVID. And one of the big key things for us is we have to stop the drop. We really do have to stop the drop for teenage female participation falling off. And on the back of that, well, we've also published a meaningful playing time report. And on that, there's a number of key initiatives. And what we're saying is we're going to relook at how we do that, how we retain those players, and how we ensure that those players are getting adequate playing time at the appropriate level. And I think that's the key to it. And we've got to make things enjoyable. It's not all about the elite player. It has to be about the club membership. And if we get those things right, then 10% is very achievable for us. And we can go beyond 10%. But I think recognising it's a short period of time and the challenges for female sports participation are there. A big key to us is to ensure we retain our teenagers.
The final of the key targets that you outlined is increasing capacity for coach, referees and volunteers through education and development programmes. Who will be the key stakeholders that the Camogie Association will target in order to try and build this capacity? You know, how is that going to be achieved?
Yeah. Well, I mean, in terms of match officials and referees, I mean, what we've recently set up over the last couple of years are female referee academies, and we would see them as one of our target to bring female players back into the game. And I suppose that's really very important for us, is that we have more female referees. And I think by targeting them directly, and even targeting them before they maybe stop playing the game, we're going to bring them back in. And it is a bit similar with coach development as well. We have enormous capacity at coach development level, but we need to target to ensure that we are targeting the right people to be participating on these courses, and that they are the right courses, and upskilling people so that they're confident both to be match officials and to be coaches and other elements. And then the final pillar in terms of the administrators is, one of them is a female leadership initiative, and that is about giving female administrators the key skills, I suppose, to give them the confidence to step into administration and to move up the path of administration. I mean, in many ways, what we're looking at is we're looking at an association where there is a role for you all the way from very nursery right up throughout all of your career, and that you're moving through your career throughout the Camogie Association. And vitally important, we're retaining you at every level of that career.
There's been huge steps made in promoting Camogie, particularly over the last number of years, and these targets weren't published blindly. They were published on the back of research that the Camogie Association carried out, and maybe we can delve into some of that. And can we start with the positive club experiences that the study revealed?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that was what we really wanted to do. We wanted to place these on the back of evidence, really, because otherwise they were just going to be probably in lots of ways just ambitions written down in a plan that maybe we weren't going to be able to achieve. And plan is no use. We're very clear on that. A strategic plan is no use unless it's achievable and unless we implement it. So this is key. This is the first time we did a large level of research. And part of that was the club satisfaction. And I think what we saw was maybe thought, but I suppose this gives us the evidence, is that 90% of people, of respondents, were actually happy with their club. They felt that they were friendly, they were value for money. 82% the quality of the coaching in their club was exceptional, and the organisation of the club and the competitive games. So on every single one of those targets and categories, we were reaching over 80% satisfaction with their club. And that is an enormous target, you know, an enormous satisfaction level with your club. And what we need to do is, in many ways, we need to build upon that and roll that out further into county and national. But even the county and national, I suppose, responses were very satisfactory for us, and they gave us enormous confidence going into the plan.
The study did also reveal something that would maybe be in line with what would be typical of people involved in the GA, and that's there was a high amount that had been in the club for more than a decade. Is that right?
Absolutely, yeah. 41% of people have been a member of the club for more than 10 years. And I think that's interesting when, you know, the demographics of our membership is quite young. So it is interesting. We see this across the Gaelic Games that the club becomes, you know, your original club or your home club in many ways is the club that you remain with. And there is lots of reasons for that. It may be that people are so satisfied with their club, they're happy with the club, and it's the traditional club in lots of ways that they've always stayed with. But compared to maybe other sports, what we also see is people don't tend to change clubs as much as other codes might. So if I go off to college or I move, I'll often retain my membership with my original club, and it's that attachment to your community. And I think that can be a barrier in some ways, because it can be a barrier at times in retaining players when they do go to colleges and go off to work maybe and initially. But it also, I suppose, means that there is a huge attachment to the club, and the club is so vitally important to all of the Gaelic Games family.
And you raised a good point there about, you know, some barriers maybe with people going to work or going to college or family commitments. There's a lot that can come up, and you have that, I suppose, pre-built bond when people start with a club at a young age, and they have a loyalty there that stems from when they're young. But what can the Camogie Association do to keep players in the sport when those barriers like work and college and family commitments come up as they get that bit older?
Yeah, and I think that is, we need to recognise that. Not everybody can remain with the club that they always were with. And one of the things that we've put in place is a social camogie initiative. Because lots of times what happens is, I may have been playing quite competitively with my club, but because of family commitments or other travel commitments or whatever, I may want to retain my original club, but I may not want to commit to playing to the same level. And I suppose one of the initiatives we're saying is this social element of camogie, because what we see for female sports is so much part of it is embedded in a social element, is that girls and females play not just for the competitive element of it, but for the friendship. So that would allow people to maintain their playing, but maybe not at the same level. And then I think we also need to recognise that in many cases, and many, many cases, there is actually no reason why somebody should not transfer from their club. If that is the best thing for them to do and they want to, we need to put in place an ability to be able to transfer from your club. You know, if I'm originally from Galway and I'm working in Dublin and I want to go to a new club, there should be an ability there to do that. Because what we want to do is we want to retain you in the Camogie Association first and foremost.
Ucdaron of the Camogie Association, Hilda Breslin. It's a very ambitious plan, but it sounds like you've got many plans in place to achieve it. Thank you so much for your time in walking through this with me.
Not at all. Thank you for having me.
Thanks very much, Hilda. Much appreciated.
Thanks.
And that was Hilda Breslin, Ucdaron of the National Camogie Association, on the 2024-2027 strategic plan. Next on Health and Fitness, we'll hear about the difficulties people living with neuromuscular conditions have accessing third level education.
Health and Fitness with the newly refurbished Midlands Park Health and Fitness Club. Take the plunge in a new routine with our swimming pool, plunge pool, jacuzzi, sauna and steam room. For more, visit MidlandsParkHotel.com. Midlands
103. You're very welcome back to Health and Fitness on Midlands 103. Accessible third level education may seem like a given for most people, but for some it can be a lot more challenging. Muscle Dystrophy Ireland has published its Inclusive Pathways, Navigating Third Level Education for Students with Neuromuscular Conditions report, which highlights the experiences of students with neuromuscular conditions in Ireland. In an extensive report, it also makes several recommendations to government and policymakers based on the issues raised by individuals with these conditions. Alan Bratnock is CEO of MDI. He joins me on the line this evening, as does Fatia Akka, who's a member of MDI and lives with a neuromuscular condition. They're going to walk me through this new report. Alan, maybe we'll start with you. How did the report come about?
Well, I suppose inclusive education sounds like the ideal solution for the state and for our members and for other disability organisations. But sometimes inclusive education and inclusive accessibility doesn't always fit the bill. And we've identified over the last couple of years, as more of our members are attending third level institutions, that some of the challenges are growing. And as our members are attending third level institutions, the challenges they face on an ongoing basis seem to be growing. And the full understanding of disability inclusion and accessibility seems to be off the mark. And we identified as an organisation that we needed to, I suppose, develop some sort of understanding and share that understanding with the policymakers in Ireland to seek change going forward. And our key elements from the report looked at data transparency, to look at the numbers of people attending third level institutions with a neuromuscular condition, to look at accessibility audits, to look at where third level institutions can identify some of the weaknesses in their accessibility, and maybe then to assign or design the capital infrastructure that the third level institution apply for around those accessibility audits. And I suppose the final piece of the report identified that financial supports for our members and individuals attending third level institution who have a disability, that the costs of attending third level institution do creep up, and that for the government to look at reform of the financial supports and tailoring grants to support our members to attend third level institutions.
Alan, you mentioned one part there I'd just like to elaborate on, and it was the data transparency you mentioned maybe right at the beginning. Could you maybe elaborate a bit on that and how you feel that could be useful coming out of a report like this?
I suppose with any change, looking at the numbers and the impacts and the stats behind what's been asked, and sometimes, you know, stats can be cold and numbers can be cold rather than looking at the lived experience and the real understanding. But looking at the data in respect of how many people are attending third level institutions with a neuromuscular condition, how many of those in our community that are attending that need additional accessibility supports, respective access due to power chairs and not just wheelchair accessibility, to understand the numbers and the demand behind those figures, I think is key for the policymakers and for the state to make informed decisions around funding structures for third level institutions. And I think that's one piece of the jigsaw puzzle that we have yet to realise. And I think it's prudent upon the state and for Department of Health and Department of Education to get a firm figure on what that is.
Fatih, I'll pass over to you here. You live with a neuromuscular condition, so you'd be best placed to tell us about some of the challenges you face on a day-to-day basis. Could you walk me through some of those?
As you know, I have listened to Sophie and I use a power chair full time. I need help 24/7. Every aspect of my life, I would need help with. And that includes going to college, going to school, and so like taking notes, for example. I would need a TA, do that hurry. Taking things out of my bag, I would need a TA to do that hurry. Opening doors, navigating the school, just even going to social events, I would need help to do that. There's every aspect of my life, I need help.
And how do you feel that you know, the colleges would be best placed to assist you with stuff like that?
Listening to us. So, in my experience, my teachers were brilliant. They accommodated me and they helped me in the physical aspects of my course. But then there's other aspects where my disability officer, she had to have be convinced to do certain things. And that is a struggle where I have to advocate for myself a lot. When I know myself the best, so I know what I need.
And it must make it challenging to have to, you know, do things like that every day, because you feel like, you know, maybe people aren't listening to you.
It is. It's hard. And it's not just like every asset that I had other hate, but then also in school, it's a struggle. It's hard and it's exhausting. I still need to do it, but it's still exhausting.
Alan, maybe I'll pass back to you here for a minute. So staff training is clearly a vital part of, you know, making education more inclusive. But are there other resources that third level institutions can avail of in order to assist people living with neuromuscular conditions, you know, technology, anything like that, that could help?
Well, I think technology is a huge leveler and enables us to, I suppose, level the playing field. So what I suppose post-COVID or COVID brought us is the opportunity to broaden education, where it doesn't always have to be a classroom-based or theatre-based, remote learning is available. And I think the growth and the funding support to grow that space is going to be hugely advantageous to some of our members of the community we support, to allow them engage in their learning and developing their third level qualifications remotely. And that accessibility is hugely important, and improved funding and increased funding in that area is needed and appreciated. And I think then, as we mentioned, improving accessibility audits across third level institutions, providing funding that is geared toward reviewing those accessibility audits is going to be extremely important. And then I suppose the last piece then is around, you know, understanding and reforming the financial supports to our members and to individuals with a disability attending a third level institution, to I suppose level the playing field and to provide accessibility.
Fatia, the report brings attention to issues like isolation and the need to foster an inclusive campus. How do you feel third level institutions would be best placed to tackle the issues of isolation that people with neurological conditions may face?
So in every campus, there is a social area, an area where students can meet and do different clubs and societies. Some of these areas are not accessible. For example, not college, their society area is not accessible. And also, it's not just in social, like, in a society sense, but also in a classroom sense. As in my experience, certain classrooms were not accessible. And I did a film course, so when my classmates had to use the computer rooms upstairs, I had to stay by myself downstairs. I think if they just did a simple lift in that, in the college, that I would have been able to be with my classmates, and then we could talk to each other and help each other with their courses and our assignments. But because I was alone, I had to wait for my teacher to come downstairs to ask them for advice and what I need to do. So I think making places accessible to not just able-bodied people, but everybody is one of the biggest things. And also ensuring that if a event is happening, it is accessible as well.
Alan, just one final question before I let you both go. The report has been published, it's been launched. What's next for Muscle Dystrophy Ireland? Where do you go from here with the report?
I think the next step, I suppose, is to share the report as widely as possible. As we move into a new period and potentially a new government in 2025, it's about talking to the departments talking to the potential leaders and those people who can support change going forward, and sharing this report with those and identify, I suppose, quick wins and, I suppose, some longer term solutions to the challenges that our members face and people like Fatia face on a day-to-day basis. I think if we move in that direction and we start talking about universal design, we start talking about accessibility audits in its truest sense, I think we will have achieved a lot.
A very eye-opening report from Muscle Dystrophy Ireland. Alan Bratnock, CEO of MDI, Fatia Acca, member of MDI. Thank you both so much for your time this evening. Let me know your thoughts on that report on 083 3010 103. After the break on Health and Fitness on Midlands 103, we'll hear from Brezzy.
Health and Fitness with the all-new Midlands Park Health and Fitness Club. With fitness classes to suit everyone, experience the warmth at 30 degrees in our dedicated spin studio. Discover all this and more on MidlandsParkHotel.com. Midlands
103. You're very welcome back to the programme. The people around you are the most important people in your lives. I'm quoting Blizzard's frontman and mental health campaigner Brezzy there, who's bringing the Where Is My Mind show to Athlone next week. Ahead of the show, the Mullingar man has been catching up with my colleague Courtney Callaghan on what it's about.
The whole idea of the podcast is trying to help people make better sense of the kind of head-melty chaos that we live in. And like a lot of people sometimes realise, put an awful lot of emphasis on themselves, on why they're overwhelmed and there's something they're not quite doing right. I'm much more interested in the environment that surrounds us that makes us feel that way. And so often things like the wellness industry doesn't talk about stuff like that. It just tells you that it's completely up to you to deal with your own stuff. And it is. It's you know, you've got to take personal responsibility. But the podcast is also about like what surrounds us, what influences us, what makes us feel that way. And it's been going well over 5 years now.
What does the name Where Is My Mind signify, or where did you come up with it to call it that?
It's actually one of my favourite bands, the Pixies, have a song called Where Is My Mind. And to me, you know, as somebody who teaches mindfulness, it is kind of the question you ask within mindfulness. Have you ever asked people, like, where is your mind? They don't know. They don't know which way is up some days, and they don't know where it is. It's stuck in the past. Is it kind of worrying about the future? Is it all over the shop? Is it in 50 different places at the same time? And that's the overwhelm that we start to feel. And we really fear the mind. A lot of people fear it rather than try and understand it and trying to get some kind of clearing of what's going on up there. And I always say this about the mind. It's a phenomenal thing. Like, as much as things like AI want to try and figure it out, it will never, ever, ever, ever figure out the human mind. It is phenomenal. And I always say that to people, take a bit of time to try and understand your mind. Don't be looking at other people's, or don't be taking, you know, straight up advice from people who don't know who you are. You need to navigate that yourself. And my job is to kind of give you the ability to critically think about that, not to give you lectures on how to do it.
Like, everyone's so different, and it takes time for everyone to figure out themselves where their own mind is and where it's at and how to get it to a place where they want it to be as well.
Totally. And that's why I don't like to just start throwing out advice at people. I don't know what anyone's carrying or what they're dealing with or how they've reacted to it. And I often find sometimes social media does that, or you get people who say these are the top three ways to deal with such and such. That kind of pop psychology isn't massively useful for people who might be in the midst of something. And I think for me, the thing I'm most interested in is, number one, telling people that what surrounds us can overwhelm us. But secondly, I think John O'Donoghue, who's an Irish poet and philosopher who's been hugely influential in my work, he said there's a place within everybody that's never been wounded. And that's kind of what I'm trying to get people to recognize. You don't need to be more resilient. You don't need to be a better version of yourself. You don't want to be all these slogans that we throw at people. You just need to recognize what's already within you and recognize that the people around you are the most important people in the world. It isn't the people who you think you know on social media. It's the people who are directly in front of you. And that's kind of what I'm trying to get across in the podcast. It's a very simple approach. It is not a lecture. And I certainly don't believe anyone who comes on a podcast and tells you they've it all figured out is telling the truth, because none of us do.
It's so important that you say that as well. It's not a lecture. It's easy for people to kind of come out and say whatever. But when people are telling you, you have to be this way, or you have to be that way, it can just make you not want to talk about it at all then, I suppose, and go back into yourself.
Well, if they don't know who you are, it's very difficult. There's certain things you can say to people. Like, there's things like saying, like, exercise is important and drinking water and all these kinds of things. But when it comes to an individual's anxieties or their moods or stuff like that, it's basically their life experiences up to that point. And somebody on a podcast doesn't really know what they are. So what I do is I get experts. I try to make it understandable for people. I give them all the information so they can apply it to their own life and then decide, you know, what is it that I need to do? But I do find it difficult. I find it difficult with the amount of information and the amount of lecturing that we are telling people how to live these optimal lives. Like, it's just not reality for 99% of us. Like, we're not trying to live these perfectly optimal lives with perfect amounts of sleep and the actual adequate, perfect amount of water and food in any given day. We'd love to do that. I'd love to do that. But it's not reality for me. And I don't think it's reality for most people I talk to. So these are the things I try to get across in the podcast. You know, and one of the brilliant kind of points that was made in the podcast by Richard Hogan, he's like, most of us are just okay most of the time. And that's grand.
And how do you find that the live shows connect with people based on the response that you would have gotten?
Your first job in a live show is to entertain people. Your job isn't to go up there on stage and start reflecting on life. It's to entertain them. They need to have the crack when they go to a live show. Even if it's a subject that might be, you know, slightly more kind of difficult for some people. But I have to make it not difficult for people. I have to make it accessible and fun and humorous, to be honest with you. And I look back at my life and the state of my mind. And I do it with humor, music, you know, monologues, spoken word, and guests. That's how I do it. And, you know, people will go to the show and they won't know what to expect. They'll think it'll be intense. It isn't. It can't be. Can't have a 2-hour live show where it's very intense. And they need to walk away like they're taking a deep breath and they've had a bit of fun doing it. And that's how I approach the podcast. And also, I mean, I've 20-odd years experience on stage, so it's where I'm most comfortable. And I try to get that across when I do my live shows.
Something that you do as well is you incorporate your music into the live podcast. Like, it's very unique to your live podcast. And how do you think that the music resonates with your audience?
Well, it tells the story, really. Like, you know, people, my life has been kind of a weird journey. I've been a professional athlete, like, which wasn't a huge part of my life. It was just something I did. I never loved it, really, to be honest with you. But music was always the kind of core part of my journey. And like, for example, I tell the story when Kurt Cobain died. Like, he was my hero and he was my peers' heroes. And we didn't know how to process what happened to him. And nobody would talk to us about it. And in fact, a teacher in my school called him a coward. That was what I was dealing with. And I tell the story. It's called Teen Spirit. It's a spoken word piece of music. And it's about the words I probably should have heard that day and the difference that would have made to me. And then I talk a lot about just different things that have happened to me that feed into the music that I've kind of specifically written for this show. It's all kind of piano based spoken words, monologues and stuff. And yeah, so I think there's another great saying that music is what language would love to be. And I think music is a brilliant way of communicating to people, and it kind of it breaks down things in people. So that's why I use it. And as you said, like, it's something I can do, and it's something I very much wanted to put into my show from the start. Well, I am a piano player. That's where I started. My mum's a piano teacher, and I got my first piano when my grandmother died. She left it to me in her will. And that was, you know, it didn't fit in our house. We had to squeeze it into the room. My parents were cursing me. But I used to sit on that thing day and night and just play and play and play. And it is, to me, the most beautiful instrument in the world, because it can do so much. It can do melody. It can do chords. It can do bass lines. And there's a lot of feel to it. So I love bringing the piano. And when you put it into a theater, it sounds beautiful. Like, and I think a lot of people, there's probably some kind of research somewhere on piano and why it's so resonating with people, why it kind of gets through to them. But I just love playing it. And I think because I'm completely lost when I do it, I think people kind of go into that place themselves. And I've kind of composed an album now at this point of new tracks that are kind of neoclassical piano pieces that I've been trying to write for years, and I never had the nerve, to be honest with you.
And Brezzy, you're bringing your live podcast at Lone's Dean Crow Theatre Saturday, the 13th of April. And you're going to be joined by the brilliant Desi Dolan, manager of the Westmeath County team.
I am Desi. I played with Desi. I played with him for quite a while. He's a good friend of mine. I've done a little bit of work with the Westmeath lads this year, you know, on some of their mindfulness stuff. and me and Desi are as a pretty close, and he's a very interesting guy, and people kind of forget behind it all. He was one of the he has definitely one of the best footballers this country has ever produced, if I'm honest. So yeah, and I kind of said to him, listen, would you be up for it? And Desi like would be private enough guy, like, you know, you have to hold that the right way with Desi. He's a very friendly guy, but you know, like everybody, you when you get to the stage, it can be a different thing. So, you know, I said to him, listen, I think the crowd will love it. I think they'll learn a lot from you, the way you've looked at the world, the way you've dealt, and obviously with the success with me last week, that'll be a great conversation as well.
And that was Brezzy speaking to Courtney Callaghan ahead of his Where Is My Mind show, which you can go see in the Dean Crow Theatre in Athlone next Saturday, the 13th of April. Next up on Health and Fitness on Midlands 103, we hear from a man who ate a bag of sugar in his campaign to lose weight.
Health and fitness with the all-new Midlands Park Health and Fitness Club, where relaxation meets rejuvenation. Find out more at midlandsparkhotel.com. Midlands
103. You're very welcome back to the programme. When you hear of weight loss, what do you think of? Fruit, veg, low-fat foods, exercise, right? Well, how about eating a bag of sugar? Probably doesn't pop into the minds of most people, but Oisin Mulligan of Mulligan's in Athlone is challenging the traditional ideas around weight loss and the foods you can eat. He's been telling my colleague Peter Dunn about the process he went through to lose weight.
There's a big thing on social media about people walking into supermarkets saying that this is poison or this is a fattening food that's going to make you overweight. And I'd see a lot of it on social media, people afraid of foods. Like there's actually an eating disorder surrounding it. It's called orthorexia. It's where you're very specific about the food you eat because you're afraid in case something makes you gain fat. And I just wanted to show people that there's no specific food that makes you gain fat. And the first food that comes to mind when people think that it's going to make you gain fat is sugar. So I was like, okay, I'm going to eat as much sugar as I can and lose weight at the same time. So then nobody can ever say again that it's sugar that causes fat gain. Solely, yes, the overconsumption of any food can cause fat gain because of calories and stuff. So that's what I kind of aimed to do over the last 2 weeks. Now, again, to preface this, I wasn't telling people to go out and eat as much sugar as possible. The goal was to just prove that it is not just singly sugar and that, like, again, sugar can actually be incorporated in an overall healthy diet. We don't have to remove it all. And it's easier to have a healthy diet if we incorporate the foods that we enjoy because we can keep it up for longer. And I think that that's a big part of dieting and stuff that's lost because people are like, oh, I have to cut out all my favorite foods in order to lose weight. They last like 6 weeks doing that and then end up putting all the weight back on because it's unsustainable. My goal is sustainable weight loss to get people to lose it and keep it off over the long run because everybody can lose weight. Like that's not an issue. I think the issue actually is losing it and keeping it off because say you're 90 kilos and your goal weight is 70 and you get down to 70 unsustainable methods, you cut out everything, right? If you go back up to 90, then after you're actually going to be more upset up your 90 kilos after the fact of losing it rather than not losing it at all. So my goal was to stop that from happening and just allow people to lose weight slowly and keep it off while including the foods they enjoy. And I think I succeeded in the challenge. So I lost 5 pounds over the space of 2 weeks. I had like one full bag of sugar one morning. I had 5 cans of Coke one morning. Two bags of...
A full bag of sugar?
Yes.
No way.
By the spoon.
you sat down in like a kg bag.
Yeah, and this is the thing as well. So I'm not to approve by that. People tell me sugar is addicting. Sugar isn't addicting. Food that tastes nice is addicting. So like highly processed foods that is really palatable, and it's not just the sugar content, because if you think of any food that you think is really tasty and really addicting and you can't stop eating, it's generally not just high in sugar, it's high in fat as well. And actually the texture of it is proven to kind of make it that little bit more enjoyable, and so that's why people overeating it. So I wanted to show people that look, if you sat down, and I would guarantee if you sat down to eat a bag of sugar, you wouldn't find it enjoyable, you wouldn't find it addicting. And so I sat down and ate a whole bag of sugar one day. Yeah, it was painful.
My god, how did you feel after that?
So initially, actually, because I think the hype of the challenge, I didn't feel too bad. As the week went on, I got a little bit more hungry because 80% of my calories were coming from sugar throughout the day. So I didn't really have much to fit in, much fruit, much veg, much protein to keep me full, which I would advise most people try and do. So then over the period coming towards the end of 2 weeks, I was feeling a little bit more hungry. But the tiredness, I actually wasn't too bad. Again, I think the reason why most people feel tired and they blame it, let's say, solely on sugar is actually because they don't do any movement throughout the day. So I'm a big proponent of getting sunlight in my eyes every single morning, trying to get out and get some form of movement in to wake me up before I do anything else. I try and make sure I get some sort of exercise and activity in. And if most people did that, I don't think that they would feel as shitty as they do, let's say.
So what did your diet look like when you were undertaking this challenge?
Okay, so I would wake up, I'd get the sugar done first thing in the morning because I had to record it and upload the videos and everything to show people what I was doing. So I'd get up, weigh myself, then eat whatever sugar. So let's go, for example, the can of Coke day. I had 5 cans of Coke. I just downed them back to back.
And that's your original Coke, not your Coke Zero?
Yeah, not Coke Zero, okay. Just original Coke. I actually did experiment as well. So I drank a can of Coke Zero to show people that that doesn't cause an insulin spike and that doesn't make you cause fat... gain fat either, because a lot of people think, oh, the sweet taste in my mouth causes insulin to spike, and then what's going to happen is I'm going to gain fat off the back of that with the Coke Zeros as well, which actually isn't the fact. And then I proved the point that Coke Zero alone doesn't cause cancer either, which is out there that people think because of aspartame, which is actually disproven too in scientific research that's done on humans. And so then what I wanted to do was drink the 5 cans of normal Coke to show people that I could still lose weight and do that. So I had the 5 cans of Coke in the morning time. The next meal I had was a big chicken salad. So I literally had one packet of chicken from the deli. Do you know the kind of deli meats that you'd buy? And then I just had a whole thing of salad, like massive bowl. And I'd always say this to people. I don't know if I'm allowed to curse on this show, but a big... bowl of salad is what everybody should have every single day, filled with chicken. And so I had that was loads of protein, kept me full, and then I'd have a chicken curry later on in the evening time. And that's kind of what my day looked like. Then I'd get my jiu-jitsu session in the evening time or a walk or whatever I could.
Okay. So you were still exercising. You were still eating healthy, even though you were consuming a lot of sugar.
Yeah, so exactly. It was that thing of moderation. The rule that I would generally go by for most people is 80-20. So 80% of your food's from whole nutritious foods. We all know what they are. And 20% of the food's from foods that we enjoy. And that would be kind of the goal with most people, is that you're able to sit down at evening time, have your biscuit or have a bar of chocolate, but also outside of that you understand that, okay, I do need these nutritious foods as well.
I often find that when people are trying to lose weight, they might be good Monday to Saturday, then they might go and have a takeaway, Chinese takeaway, and then they just go, I've ruined it all. When you haven't ruined it all.
That's exactly the message. Like, bang on the point, the message that I'm trying to get across is, if we can remove that guilt and that badness, because often people think of and I did this challenge a couple of years back as well with McDonald's. I ate McDonald's for 2 whole weeks and I lost 5 pounds doing the exact same thing. But the reason I did that was to prove that point, that if you have a food that's classed as bad or not good for you, that you don't necessarily gain fat or that you haven't ruined anything. And like, if you think about your McDonald's that you have, if you have it every, say, month or every 2 months or 3 months or however long, if you look at the overall picture of your diet, it's not that big of a deal. Like, look at 365 days of the year in comparison to that one day that maybe you had a McDonald's.
Yeah.
That's not going to impact your health. It's like putting a drop of little pink dye inside a big massive tub of water. You wouldn't even know that the dye is in there. Do you know that kind of way?
So I think
that's the message I tried to get across, because if we can remove the guilt and badness from food, a lot of people will be a lot more healthy and successful with regards to their weight loss attempts.
Yeah, I mean... there's another theory that if we get 99 compliments and one insult, we'll focus on that one insult.
Yeah.
You know, it's how we're wired, you know what I mean? It must be the same with nutrition. You know, if we feel we've fallen off the wagon, we focus on that one thing and we beat ourselves up over it.
Yeah, and I think it's a lot worse with nutrition, because for years we've seen things of like magazines with people on it with extra weight on them being like, this person's gained 22 pounds, or being through previous diet history of poor diets that say that certain foods are bad, or you can only have so many points of this food, or if you have this food that you're going to gain fat and completely cut it out. Like, look at the most popular diets, right? And I won't name any brands or anything, but you would think of paleo, keto, any of those type of ones. They cut out a whole entire food group. And like, look, if that works for you, that works for you, fine. But it doesn't work for 99% of people, because they'll lose weight and then gain it back. And when I'm asking people if a diet is working, it's looking at that. It's not looking at if you've lost weight. Most people would say, oh, I've lost weight doing keto. It's like, okay, is the weight, first of all, still off? And how long have you been doing it for, if you have still kept the weight off? Probably less than 6 months, because I'd say after 6 months, you're not going to be able to stick to it very long. So that would be the goal with it. But I think like that thing of badness and really focusing on the negatives is really apparent with most people already who are overweight, because they're not confident. And I was in a position, I used to be 130 kilos and I ended up losing all the weight. Every single little thing that I had done negatively, let's say, with my nutrition, it was instantly back to, you're fat, you're overweight, you can't stick to things, you've no willpower. The second I started to change that mindset surrounding food is when I kept the weight off, because I've lost it loads of times before and I never ever kept it off. But it was that one time I started, and the reason I changed that is because my brother was beside me telling me, look, Ushan, you're fine, everybody enjoys the takeaway, you're a human being if you enjoy nice food, rather than what would have been put out there before by classmates or whoever I was around just calling me fat or whatever. Of course, then if I have a takeaway, the instant thing that I think of is, I'm fat, I'm overweight, I can't do it, and I give up altogether. together. And I think that that's a huge thing. Like, how I describe it is, if we look at Floyd Mayweather goes out and has a takeaway. There's loads of pictures of him up online eating takeaways or burgers or whatever. He doesn't instantly, after having that takeaway, go, I'm fat, I'm overweight, I can try and give up boxing, I can't do this. Instantly. No, because he sees himself as an athlete. And it's just that self-image that if we start to change, and that self-image isn't helped by this proponent of bad food, because when they eat the bad food, they become the bad person then, because it's bad food that they're eating and they give up altogether. It's huge, and I think there's so much in that that needs to be touched on regards to nutrition knowledge and nutrition understanding from not only nutritionists and personal trainers but also medical professionals, because there'd be a lot of poor information given out there by them guys as well, and it's just due to lack of understanding and lack of training. And if you're wondering why I have that understanding, is because I was there. I was 120 kilos. I know that picture of what it's like. Meanwhile, most of the people that are at my weight or lost weight to get down there aren't even confident enough to go on social media and spread a good message, because they don't have that confidence in themselves. And I've slowly built that up over time, whether it be challenging myself, even as we're going to talk about with the marathon. This is the thing that I do all the time, to just try and prove myself I can do things and build up that self-confidence that I have.
And that was Oisín Mulligan of Mulligan's in Athlone. What are your thoughts on his weight loss methods? Let me know on 083 3010 103. That is, unfortunately, all the time we've got on Health and Fitness on Midlands 103 this evening. Your usual host, David Hollywood, will be back on your airwaves at the same time next week, Friday at 7 o'clock. Joe Cooney is going to bring you some of the best tracks in country music in less than 10 minutes' time before Anne-Marie Kelly brings you Roadhouse Cafe at 10 o'clock. But that's all after the news at 8 o'clock. Thank you so much for listening. I'll catch you next time.